their bodies lying unmoved under the stars, covered by hastily arranged twigs by some murderer who lives among us? Peter Clack, The Canberra Times, November 17, 1991.
February 26, 2021 falls on a Friday. It's the anniversary of a Friday 50 years earlier when 20-year-old pregnant Keren Rowland vanished from alongside Canberra's Lake Burley Griffin. Her remains found almost 3 months later in the eerie surrounds of the Fairburn Pine Plantation. As it transpires, the numerous unanswered questions surrounding what occurred are echoed in other equally baffling local cases that have followed in the wake of that tragedy. Might any of them be linked in the most insidious fashion? I'm Nicole Overall, creator and host of the Capital Crime Files podcast, and this case file fragment, which are provided as snapshots of developments as they're occurring, arises from questions I've consistently had asked of me about the potential for such a nefarious connection between the cases I'm exploring. Inevitably, these conversations raise the much-discussed spectre of one of Australia's most notorious serial killers, Ivan Milat. Others who may have been subjected to Milat's cruelty had again become a trending topic as the nation held its breath, awaiting his deathbed confession while he lay dying of cancer at the end of 2019. Like a soul he may well have been without, it never materialised. And so, the speculation continues. Almost precisely 3 years on from Keren's unexplained death, on Sunday, March 31, 1974, only a few days before her 28th birthday, mother of three, Mary Bertram, left home, never to return. 4 days later, her stripped and strangled body was found in scrub near Sutton, around 20 kilometres from where Keren had been discovered. As described in the press, Mary was hidden behind a tree stump. Police searched in vain for an unidentified man apparently known to her, said to go by the name of Bob. 20 years after Keren disappeared, 29-year-old mother and wife, Diane Panaccio, was last seen alive prior to seeking a lift between the small hamlet of Bungendore and Queanbeyan late on a Friday night. Close to 2 months later, her body would be stumbled across deep in the dense Talagand Estate forest. Covered with pine branches, Diane had been stabbed in the back and potentially sexually assaulted. On November 16, 1991, Peter Clack of the Canberra Times wrote,
"The circumstances of her disappearance and subsequent discovery in bushland mirrors the 1971 death of Canberra woman Keren Rowland."
The full exploration of Diane and Mary's cases, including interviews with family members, will be presented in seasons 2 and 3 of Capital Crime Files. Unfortunately, so are there others. With a degree of unavoidability, the ugly shadow of the now-dead backpacker murderer Ivan Milat has fallen over these and other regional cases. There are various, perhaps valid, reasons why. I do not claim to be a Milat expert, nor do I have any desire to become one. I have researched any number of the untold references to him and the crimes for which he was sentenced, as well as many of those with which he has come to be linked. My primary sources in relation to any alleged involvement with cases within the vicinity of the ACT are the 2014 book Milat by Clive Small and Tom Gilling and a case study in cross-examination by Dan Howard SC, junior counsel to Mark Tedeschi, who prosecuted the case against him. I can personally attest I have been told Milat was said to frequent the Canberra area, allegedly around one of the periods he was working with the Department of Main Roads. Stories that still circulate, certainly more than just yarns told after a pint or two, that he'd stay at one of the local pubs. Less than 2 months after Keren Rowland was first officially listed in the 4-inch-thick missing friends book kept by the ACT police, and a month prior to her body being found. On the April Easter weekend of 1971, two 18-year-old female hitchhikers were offered a lift from a man willing to drive them from Liverpool on the outskirts of Sydney, the 3 hours to the national capital, Canberra. According to accounts of subsequent court proceedings, near Goulburn, the driver detoured to a secluded spot, threatened them with a knife, and perpetrated sexual violence on one before both managed to escape. The assaulted woman would state she recalled asking whether he had ever done this type of thing before, to which he allegedly replied that he often picked up hitchhikers. A 26-year-old construction worker and later truck driver was charged with the crime, Ivan Robert Marco Malat. Detailed as an ugly trial to question the credibility of the women involved saw him earn a get-out-of-jail-free card. Slipping prison, he also slipped the country later that year, having left behind his shoes at the Gap in Sydney, the spectacular sandstone clifftop notorious for suicides. Rather than stepping off and changing history, he wound up in New Zealand, where various sources state he remained for around 12 months. Certainly he was back in Australia by early April 1974, arrested by police at his mother's hospital bedside during a visit. Some 2 decades later, he'd inspire the biggest manhunt in Australian history for the murder of 7 backpackers between 1989 and 1992, their bodies disposed of in the depths of the Belangolo Forest, approximately halfway between Sydney and Canberra. All were hitchhikers in their late teens and early 20s. 5 of them were women. Some of them had been sexually assaulted, though criminal analysis of the scene suggested sex did not seem to dominate the killer or killer's behaviour. In any number of the untold reports that have subsequently circulated, each was said to have been located face down, hands behind their backs, lying against logs, covered with leaves and bracken, and stabbed or shot to death. So too, suggestions of strangulation. At least one, apparently with a fractured hyoid bone. As detailed in Season 1, Episode 3 of Capital Crime Files, a potential indication of strangulation. Only 3 months before Malat's arrest in May 1994, Canberra journalist Peter Clack drew comparisons between the bodies found in Belangolo and Diane Panaccio's murder. At that juncture, the AFP advanced their own unsolved cases for review, including Kerrin's. By the end of November 1993, there'd be headlines stating police note similarities between Panaccio serial murders. However, the notion of a connection would apparently later be dismissed. One who has subsequently publicly asserted the potential for Malat's prospective regional exploits is Clive Small, who'd been head of Task Force Air, responsible for bringing Malat undone. As an aside, other podcasts that have detailed Malat's timeline suggest the police surveillance of his Eagle Vale home commenced on February 26, 1994, precisely 23 years after Kerrin's disappearance. According to his 2014 book on Malat, Clive Small seemed firm in the view that Kerrin, for whom he adopts the pseudonym Mary and refers to the date she went missing as February 20 rather than February 26, had been raped and, it appeared, she had been strangled. Such assertions remain a point of contention given the inconclusive findings of the coronial inquest. The former top cop backs himself by revealing that work records also indicated that Ivan was working nearby and had the opportunity. In a supporting account, Malat is said to have the next day reported for work at Liverpool. According to this, his workmates later recall him boasting that he has killed a man and buried the body in the bush. Similar was Small's summation when it came to Diane Panaccio. Referring to her as Michelle, he'd write that she had been sexually assaulted. Also, that a number of personal items, including jewellery, were found to be missing, but their value did not suggest the motive for taking them was profit. On page 164, he'd continue. As with the first case, referring to Keren, the location of the attack, its timing and circumstances, the burial of the victim, and the apparent taking of mementos all suggested Ivan could have been involved. Work records again indicated that Ivan had the opportunity. Sergeant Adam Reinhardt of the Australian Federal Police, AFP, lead detective in the current reinvestigation of unsolved homicides in Canberra, says that the possibility of Malat's involvement locally is being seriously explored.
Well, that is a significant part of the investigation, and that's at the moment where we are. I can't rule him in, and I certainly can't rule him out. That doesn't mean we're not going to try. There is a lot more sort of material that we're looking for with Malat, and that will involve going through boxes and boxes. I think there's 400 boxes of material that New South Wales have got on the Malat investigation, which we'll be lucky enough to go through, and what associates he had, or links to the ACT, reasons why he might have been in Canberra in February 1971, what motor vehicles he had at the time, or had access to at the time, his work history to show reasons to be in the ACT.
Along with looking for specific references in relation to Keren Rowland, this search will also relate to other unsolved murders and disappearances in Canberra.
And with that, we'll have a view to refer to anything Keren related, but also our other unsolves or missing people, see if there's anything that fits in with them. For all these cases like Keren and the other missing people, there'll be a question of, well, was it Malat? And so here's an opportunity for us to have a look at all those jobs all at once and then maybe not get some answers.
Then there's the matter I reference at the end of episode 3 of Capital Crime Files' first season, Keren's missing bracelet. The only item unaccounted for at the scene of her death, a goldy-coloured bracelet absent from her otherwise untouched handbag.
The mystery of the bracelet is something I'm very keen on. And what we know about that is that earlier that night she'd gone to the Canberra show and bought the bracelet for her friend Lynette. Lynette never received the bracelet and family members never saw it. So that's an outstanding piece of evidence that we would love to know what happened to it. And potentially it's, you know, sitting in someone's jewellery box for 50 years, or it's perhaps been taken by the offender, or perhaps it fell out of the car at some stage. We don't know what happened to it, but that is an avenue of inquiry or a question that we'd love answered. So if anyone has seen that bracelet or remembers hearing about it or seeing anything to do with it, that's a small bit of info that'll be very crucial to us.
On December 8, 2020, the launch date of this podcast, the AFP conducted a new search for the elusive piece of jewellery in the pine forest close by the air disaster memorial where Keren's body was found. While they came up empty-handed in that regard, the resulting publicity has generated additional information and prospective leads, including on other local unsolved crimes.
It's even things like the search, the metal detector search out at the forest. People see that in the news, they hear it on the TV, or they hear it on a podcast. They then call us and say, well, I see that you're looking for more information. Here's what I have to say.
The retention of such trophies in the case against Malat and other such murderers is well documented. Before Malat would be declared lead suspect for the Belanglo killings, an expert in profiling mass murderers and serial killers, for those who perhaps don't follow such things too closely, there is a difference. Dr. Rod Milton delivered an assessment of the person they were seeking. One aspect of Dr. Milton's hypothesis, as detailed in a 2009 doctoral thesis by Natalie Scherer on serial killers in Australia, was that the backpacker killer or killers would have kept items belonging to the victims, that the offender would have some of those items. The current review of material that may provide some definitive evidence of Malat's involvement, or not, extends to anything that might have been found in his possession.
There's a fabled video of a search warrant at his house, which we're hoping still exists, if it ever existed. That holy grail of that video is to see if that missing bracelet that we searched the forest for, see if that is sitting on a bookshelf somewhere. And that's the sort of depth that we will go to frame by frame to see if Malat can be ruled in or ruled out.
Other elements to reveal why Malat warrants such close scrutiny will also be explored more in upcoming episodes. This includes his passion for distinctive muscle cars. Among those he owned, a lime green Valiant Charger, and according to a book by Mark Whitaker and Les Kennedy, Sins of the Brother, until 1974, a mid-60s Marone Holden. The convicted killer also earned a reputation for being a prolific letter writer from his apartment-like cell in the Supermax prison in the historic New South Wales regional city of Goulburn. Anonymous letters did come to feature in the course of Kerrin's and other investigations. Some components lend themselves to the theory of someone otherwise, or perhaps even jointly, responsible. Looming large in the detail of various crime scenes are alcohol bottles and cigarette butts. Apparently obsessed with his health, it's routinely noted that Ivan Milat is said to have neither smoked nor drank. Justifiably, there is some hesitation about too much focus on Milat. Certainly in relation to the Kerrin Rowland case, the police have a long list of persons of interest that's again being combed over.
The investigation, I think, at last count that I had looked, was over 30 or so people that were nominated as potential offenders. And even today, that list is growing as people are providing us more information. And part of that as well is going through that list of persons of interest or persons who have been nominated as potential suspects and going through them one by one and as much as possible either ruling them out or ruling them in or providing, you know, identifying further avenues of inquiry to whittle that list down and hopefully one day be left with that sole person.
Almost mythical layers have also continued to be laid down over the framework of known fact, like so much fairy dust settling upon an unvarnished surface.
I think back in the 1970s, people were talking about this job quite a lot. And some people, whether it was for their own notoriety or for whatever other reason, would say, well, I know what happened to this person. Or, if you go wrong with me, then you'll end up in the forest as well. And people were quick to report that back to the police. And so they investigated those claims, those allegations. And some of them can be eliminated fairly quickly. And others, such as, you know, the Malats and other people, there's nothing to prove at this stage either way, whether they did or they didn't.
In addition, there's criticism of a fascination with conferring some sort of status on perpetrators rather than maintaining the focus on the victims. For Kerrin's younger brother Steve, the concern is that all efforts and resources aren't sucked into the black hole of an infamous serial killer nominated in virtually every missing person and unsolved murder case in the country. He also points out that such a name was never presented to the family at the time of the original investigation.
While Malat may well be a serious consideration, I wouldn't want that speculation to distract from the investigation of all and any possibilities. I don't want for the focus to be solely on him unless it is to completely rule him out, or I have some firm evidence it was him. We can't take the pressure off and make the mistakes of potentially overlooking someone else who's still out there and has never answered for it. It's not about revenge, it's justice.
Yet to come in season one of the Capital Crime Files podcast, Kerrin Rowland, The 50-Year Mystery.
It's a long, sort of slow slog reviewing these jobs because there's mountains and mountains of paperwork that we need to look through and review. And still we're going through everything and trying to work out exactly what happened to Kerrin. So one of the inquiries I wanted to make is there any damage to bones that suggest maybe a stabbing or a shooting or something like that. There's no major injuries to the body, and there's no stab wounds or apparent stab wounds to clothing. Well, we know there was no robbery because all the possessions were still there. Sexual assault, maybe not. That definitely makes it really weird as to why Kerrin was picked, why Kerrin ended up where she did. The main reasons that you would expect, if they don't exist, then that certainly makes it bizarre. For this particular case, I can't say there was a particular moment where they say this is a murder. I would suggest it happened before she was found. The level of concern for her had risen to a point where there's no reasonable explanation as to where she's gone. So it would have been treated in the same way as a murder, although the body hadn't been located.
For more, find us at capitalcrimefiles.com.au. Subscribe wherever you download your podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram.